They are perfect. So just click on here. So the title of the talk is really on a kind of review of the nature of conflict. What are the tools available for us to work with conflict? And how does the Buddhist teaching or the Dharma relate to conflict in a both a superficial level, that is, behaving in the world with a minimum of conflict, and also on the deeper level, which is a sense of really being in another mind, a non-conflict mind, and what does that take? So that's really the title of the talk. And it's really important to deal with conflict because first of all, it's something that happens to us immediately. Just as you were saying before, it's like it really feels that it happens to us. It's a fight and flight response. We have fear, and immediately conflict occurs, and it feels like it's out of control. And this is a big challenge to us, especially if we are on a spiritual path, and we're on a path of love and peace, and we love and we love peace, and then we find ourselves in conflict. And it threatens all our spiritual path. We think, well, I've failed. I didn't make it. I've been meditating for 20, 30 years, and now here I am shouting at my neighbor or my wife or my husband or someone in the street, or I don't know. And how is that possible that I've done all this spiritual practice and I'm a failure? And so conflict can seem like a test. And by the way, you'd be amazed at the way in Buddhist groups and so on, and even in the most sort of deep practice, and you find that the board of management shouting at each other. And how is that possible, given? And I think we have to understand the nature of conflict to answer that question, because conflict because it's so immediate, and because it's so associated with our defense, and because it's so associated with our survival, and it's the self bonds so immediately, any threat of this kind, someone says something to us, you're wrong, you're stupid, whatever, there is an immediate response of a contraction. The self feels threatened, and the self arises at that time. Defense is the time when the self is the strongest. Selfing, me and my boundaries, and my self-image, and my protection, and my armor, is all immediately recruited in that moment. And because it's so immediate, and it has emotion in it, and it has defense in it, it has armor in it, all of that is immediately recruited, so it's incredibly strong. And the Buddha, for example, he couldn't deal with all issues of conflict in his own monks, in his own sangha. It was sometimes too strong, the conflict. And there was one time when his monks were quarreling, and he couldn't stop it. And he said, I'm getting out of here. And he left. And he went to the forest on his own. He said, I can't stand these quarreling monks. They're fighting each other all the time about issues of course, like, you know, in the Jewish world, you know, you do things wrong, you do things you shouldn't be, reform, conservative. So they were on points of Buddhist codes of behavior. They were fighting about that. And the Buddha left, and he was in the forest, and all of a sudden an elephant arrived, and he said to the elephant, what are you doing on your own without the elephant sangha group? And the elephant said, oh, my group are fighting all the time. I'm left them, I'm much better on my own, thank you very much. They kind of, Buddha communicated with the elephant. And the elephant said, and the Buddha said, I really understand it, same with me. So, in other words, I think the message of that lovely story is, it's really strong conflict and it affects elephants, people, humans, animals. It's like such a powerful thing. And you can see it in the Middle East, by the way, because the Middle East is an intractable conflict. It's been 100 years before the state, and nobody can solve it. All the wise men, all the professors, all the academics, all the poets, all the artists, all the politicians, all the good people, all the mothers, all the grandmothers, all the children, none of them can solve the problem, which tells you that it's strong and stronger than the ordinary mind to deal with. And that's why, in a way, we have to be a little kind to ourselves and not expect that we can solve conflict just because we're sitting on the meditation cushion for a few years. We kind of a little bit humble because it's so powerful. And I mean, it's so powerful and it's so destructive. Like, you know, the wars that have been fought, recent wars of the 20th century, perhaps most of them, are not at all survival wars. The Vietnam War was on the other side of the planet. You know, and the First World War was fought because of honour. Not because England was going to be overrun by Germans and Austrians. Maybe the Second World War is perhaps a bit different. But nearly all the wars were fought because of imagined fear, not because of real threat. And I mean, the same in the Middle East, actually. When you go to the Middle East and you see the way Jews and Arabs are living together right now, Palestinians and Israelis, you cannot tell the difference. You go outside Jerusalem, they are totally integrated. You don't know when you've left Gilo and you've arrived in Beit Jala. They are touching each other, communicating, eating the same food, talking the same language, at least in that part. Living the same way, you know, same Middle East, same trees, same, and they're living together on this piece of, and they've been living 100 years together. But the narrative is, story is the enemy. So, you know, you can see the power of the conflict mind that even though people live together, they are holding in their inner world these very, very strong narratives and very strong messages and fears and labeling and distance. And these are really, really powerful, these narratives. They are hugely powerful. It's the narrative that the Vietnamese will somehow destroy America, which is, you know, in retrospect, a totally bizarre narrative, that Vietnamese peasants will destroy America. It justifies killing 3 million Vietnamese, and on reflection, it's just a narrative, and you see how powerful it is and how much suffering it causes, and nobody can get out of it. So it tells you, the take-home message here is that it's really, really strong, and out of control, out of our control, and so we really have to deal with it. It'll come at any time, in any moment, for any of us, with people close to us or far away. And it can be a group, it can be at home, it can be with our kids, it can be with ourselves, it can be with our neighbours, it can be with an ethnic group, etc., etc. And so, if we let go a little bit of our expectations that we're going to be constantly kind, loving and perfect, then we're in a sort of realm of a bit more truth, a bit more honesty and a bit more humility. And conflict shows us this. And then we begin to understand that how we are in relation to conflict is basically who we are is how we are, and how we are is who we are. That is, because we react so spontaneously to conflict, It's not possible, and this is partly an answer to you, your question, it's not really possible to design strategies that immediately solve conflict, because we're bringing our entire mind to that moment where conflict is spontaneous, strong, immediate, and threatening. So we, because of that, because it's so collecting all of us together and spontaneous, then really all we are in our life is coming to that moment. So in other words, if we are less tied into the conflict mind, it's because of all the practice we've done in our life, all the wisdom, we don't have to be Buddhist for this, all the wisdom, all the heartfulness, all the kindness, all the inner maturity that we have developed in our life is going to be expressed at that moment. So in a way, conflict is a place of who we are, and it's not possible. You can modify, you can soften it. There are things you can do, and I'll talk about them, but it's not possible to solve conflict in some technical way instantly when it happens, because we can do it maybe a bit, and then we go out in the street and someone shouts at us and boom, we're in it again. Or we do it with this group, I no longer have a problem with Muslims, then we go home and our kid says something and bah, the whole thing. You know, we have conflict in the family, or we have conflict with our don't know who, our mother-in-law, father-in-law, don't know, grandmother, friend, enemy, neighbour. So it's very, very basic, and the Buddha always talked about conflict as a symbol of samsara. And the samsara, you would say, is conditioned reality. It's the ordinary life that is conditioning us. And the Buddha used conflict as a symbol. And I'll read you a small paragraph here from a Buddhist text, which, don't get too alarmed by the language, because these are suttas, and they are kind of written in a certain traditional way and then translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and so they're not that user friendly in the language, but you'll get they're better than they used to be. When Buddhism started in the West, it was academics from London University, Victorian academics translated, and they're now much, much better, but still. So what's the, so, and I'll maybe paraphrase it a little bit. So someone asked the Buddha, what's the source of fights and quarrels and violence? And the Buddha said, he says, the source through which perceptions and ideas that are contaminated by mental, or coloured by mental, what's called proliferation, there's a Pali word for this, papancha, meaning the tendency for one thought to create another, to create another, to create another. In other words, how narratives are built, because they're in chains. They come, as soon as we have a thought, it brings another one, similar one, and then it's a similar one, and then we have a narrative, like all Palestinians are natural enemies. It's simply built by thought chains, which keep being repeated and supported again and again and again, until it's so solid, through the newspapers, through this, through this, through this, through education and whatever, till it's so solid that it seems like truth. But actually, it's proliferation of thought. Okay, so what's the source through which perceptions and ideas that are coloured by mental loops in the mind, if nothing is found there to welcome and hold on to and want in these loops, this is the end of the tendency to desire or aversion, pushing away, not want to, fear, for example, the tendency to hold onto views, the tendency to question others, the tendency of me and mine, conceit, me, I'm full of myself, the tendency for ignorance, And when the tendencies are ending, this is the end of using weapons and sticks and quarrels and fights and disputes and recrimination and malice and lying and harm through speech. And they totally end with that. So what he's saying is that there's only one way to end conflict, and that is to really understand the tendencies that we have for fear, protection, views, all the underlying tendencies, the ones really underneath, the tendency for me basically to be me defending myself in life, and all the views that I have and all the tendency, not just the views, the tendency to hold on to views, not just a view, but the tendency we have to make views the truth or make the enemy the truth, the tendency. And behind the tendency is ideas that and thoughts that turn around and around, and unless we deal with those, we will never end quarrels and fights. So he's telling us that there is a place where conflict ends completely, and the source of it is in the thought, in the way we look at reality and the way we sustain chains of thinking about reality, the other, particularly.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Isn't there something to do with how we see conflict? We see conflict as bad.
Yeah. But it's hard to see it as pleasant.
But it is what it is.
Right. Right.
When Rabbi David made that speech at peace, talked about shalom holding.
Right.
And I'm thinking about that as you're talking.
Yeah. So I'll address that in a minute. But yes, you need to see conflict as conflict. But you need to do something about it. I mean, it. Of course you need to see conflict and not ignore it and pretend that everything is peace. But you need the tools, and here are the Buddhist tools, basically to really address conflict at its root, which is based on proliferation of thought. Thought of what I... believing thought, such as Muslims are after thought.
My emotionally charged narratives are based on truth of experience that actually happened.
Yes.
I'm sure it's not, there's no short answer, but the shorter answer is let it go. Is that the direction I'm supposed to be going for? I know I'm jumping.
Yeah, first, to be very, very clear what the narratives are. And when you're very clear what the narratives are, you will see that they relate to something that has happened, but in this minute, they're not true. They are simply, the truth of them is that they're narratives. The truth is not the truth, it's not happening right now. The thing that happened to you in the past that is maybe causing a trauma, a really heavy, you know, a built-in experience that is then creating a narrative, it's no longer, it's past its sell-by date. It's no longer relevant anymore because the thing has happened and right now it doesn't exist. It's like the way, you know, the Holocaust is held, generation after generation. So there's no doubt, like all my family were killed in the Holocaust, there's no doubt that this is probably the most painful experience you can possibly imagine. There's no doubt. Can't lessen the experience. But if you hold it as a narrative, it guiding your life, popping up at every opportunity, making you full of projections about enemies, about anxiety, about holding the trauma, about, you know, making it an icon, making it... I don't want to really go into the subject because it's very emotional, but it, you see the damage it does to the joy of life of ordinary people in Israel or in New York who are holding this narrative in front of their eyes morning, noon and night, and it simply destroys the joy of life and the freedom, and it leads to a lot of conflict all the time. And that's because the narrative is seen as truth when in fact it is a memory. It is something that happened, but right now it doesn't exist. So you don't have to get rid of narratives, but if you see them, you know, like I must shoot my narrative, but if you see them as they are, you see that they're just narratives that come and go.
You're not saying that a real experience that happened is a narrative. You're saying how we keep replaying.
Yes.
What we build up from that. So a real experience, yes, is not... You could break that down and say, this is a narrative because it's how we're looking at this experience that we're having. I guess you could break it down into that.
You could.
But,
yes.
But it seems simply that you're saying that the Holocaust happened... A mother abused their child or whatever, that happened.
Yeah.
But then it's what we do with that.
Exactly. So we hold it as chains, exactly that the Buddha said. We hold it as chains or loops in the mind that don't leave us alone. And we don't notice that they're loops in the mind, and we don't notice that they're made of nothing. That they're actually just a narrative. When you look at the narrative, it's not made of anything. For example, let me go back to Vietnam, just because it's so obviously a war that really didn't bring good to anybody. I remember it, you know, because I was in the 60s, I was a kind of 60s activist at that time. And the narrative was really strong. If we don't go out and kill the North Vietnamese, they will take over the whole universe, kind of. And everyone believed, really bought into this narrative. They really believed it, they really felt threatened by it, but it was so clearly a narrative that was caught the whole culture, and it turned into a truth, and it made fear. But at the end of the war, how much people realized it was just a narrative, and it wasn't worth, you know, it was a tragedy that just needn't have happened, and it could have been let go of.
And then we developed a nothing narrative in terms of hating the soldiers when they came back.
Well, there's no, yeah, exactly.
And then we developed a story about how much we hated them.
There's no end to the narratives.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the potential you wrong me. The very potential that you have the ability and the opportunity to wrong me again is a narrative. It's a truth. You wrong me, you can wrong me again.
That's a narrative. That's a narrative. Because you don't know what the situation is going to be in 1 minute's time, or in 1 hour, or in 1 day, or in the rest of your life. You have no idea. You don't know what the future is. You know that you were wounded. That's what you know. That's all you know.
Yeah, because of years you suffered, and the other person doesn't.
I agree. No, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I go around in defensiveness.
Yeah,
the truth, there is truth in defensiveness. Yes, that is the truth. The truth is that there is a narrative. That's true, if you like. But what the narrative says is not necessarily the truth. The truth is that there is a narrative that is existing in my consciousness and turning round and round. As soon as you see it, the truth of it is there's a narrative. Okay, hello, I see you. Fine. I know you. You're with me more in the morning when I get up, and you're with me in the evening when I get up. I wish you wouldn't be with me. I'd like to let you go. It's not healthy for me. It's not healthy for others that I'm connected with. And but I see you, that you're a narrative, and you that you're back in the world of truth there. But if you believe what the narrative says, that they will always be enemies, you are closing down the situation. You're shutting down the potential for change, for freedom. You're shutting down the joy, which is the joy of life, which is much, much bigger than your narrative. So, you know, the joy of life can be total. Yes, someone could kill you. It could happen to any of us. It's possible I go in the street and someone kills me. It could happen, indeed. But I am not going to spend the rest of my life sacrificing the joy and freedom of life because I've got a narrative that he might kill me. Because the narrative is harming me, not the person. The person hasn't killed me yet. Could happen. But he hasn't done it right now. So the narrative is hurting me, not the person. So it kind of... You have to get back into the world of truth, and the world of truth is uncomfortable fact that we hold these narratives in the self as true, instead of seeing them as narratives that come and go and proliferate. And so we, you know, and there are many ways, and I'm going to talk about ways of dealing with narratives.
And they take you out of being present.
Well, they do take you out if you believe them. And if you just watch them, then you're still in the present.
Right.
Yeah. If you believe them, then you invest in them, then you're out of the present. Yeah. And therefore you're out of joy. You just don't have joy of life. I mean, it's a tragedy in Israel. It's a beautiful country, amazing people, and so much suffering, and so much unnecessary suffering, and anxiety. Anxiety is like the national disease of Israel, and it's a beautiful country and a rich country, and they've got everything they could possibly want, and it's being destroyed. My own view, I'm sorry I don't want to argue here because it's not relevant to the talk, but there's a sort of suicide going on in Israel. Unnecessary. There could be such a beautiful, beautiful life, but people are so anxious. And how long can you drag the sort of ghetto mind into the present? It's just that narrative that goes round and round and round, and generation after generation and generation. And the politicians pour fuel on the fire, increasing the fear instead of decreasing it. Big responsibility.
The narrative is true. And if it's true, what do you do with it?
A narrative is always a narrative. It's all it is.
It comes from a truth.
Well, it might have come from an event, and there might be another event in the future, but you don't know what that event is going to be, and the narrative doesn't tell you what the event is going to be, and then it closes down the possibilities. Because if you, a narrative such as the Palestinians are after me, closes down your possibility to look in the eyes of a Palestinian kid who just wants you to love him, and you will not be able to love this Palestinian kid because of your narrative. And so the Israelis cannot love the Palestinian people who are dying in a way to be loved, and the Palestinians cannot love the Israelis who are dying to be partners with people who they live next to each other. Both sides are dying to live in peace, and they cannot because they both have these narratives which they think are true.
Can I get a small example?
Maybe I'll carry on, because otherwise, and maybe we'll have a sort of discussion at the end, because it's also being taped, and so it's going to be a very long. So I'd like to sort of go through the talk and then finish the tape. Then it will not be a 2-hour tape, and then I'll turn it off and we can have some questions. I'd prefer to go that way. So what I want to rephrase things for a moment and see. Show that conflict is really an opportunity for us to practice and for us to be free. It's a challenging opportunity, like a disease. A disease, we can either be a victim, or we can use the disease for inner transformation, as you know. So. The same with conflict. The conflict can either drown us, or if we are ready, it is like the image someone said that I like is like when you have a map of a treasure island, there is an X on the map saying dig here, the treasure is underneath. And I think conflict is one of those, is the X on the map. Dig here, the treasure is underneath. Because the place of conflict is an example of expressed pain, difficulty, contraction, and all these, and they're exactly the place where we've got an opportunity to work. So it really is a place that if we seize the opportunity, it's an opportunity, just like any challenge, and it's an opportunity to grow spiritually. So therefore, we can home in on conflict as a teacher. And that's what the Buddhist teaching will invite us to do. And the main number one tool for long-term dealing with conflict is mindfulness, is awareness. And the most important part of the awareness we've already talked about, which is the awareness of narrative and not as story that we have to believe in. That comes from mindfulness. Now, if we did it ourselves just before, if we can look at the, but I mean, of course, mindfulness will bring us to like any place of more truth. For example, your pictures, you know, you're struggling as an artist. You've got a struggle, and I can't do it, and I'm, it's a problem. You know, I can't manage, and so on and so on. The minute you are mindful, you are aware of these loops in the mind. And then you're free of them. You've got a problem, but it doesn't overwhelm you because you see it for what it is. So mindfulness is a kind of a main mindful sati in the Pali language. It's the main tool for dealing with conflict, and it goes with. You said letting go. It goes with vipassana, and vipassana means seeing clearly, and what you see clearly is that it's not so hard to let things go because they go by themselves. That's vipassana. In other words, when you look at the narrative really face to face, you see that actually it's not made of anything. It's a repeating loop in the mind, and therefore it in a way goes by itself. If you see it as it is, things go by themselves. You don't have to get rid of difficult narratives or patterns. Sometimes if they're really strong, you may need to go to the psychologist to help, or you may need to, you may need other help besides this. It's okay, fair enough, to get the help where you can. But very often, mindfulness practice will show you that the loops in the mind are dynamic, and that they're just loops and they can go by themselves because they come and go. They are just passing by like everything else, but we don't see that because we get locked into them. So mindfulness and vipassana together will show you that your inner life is very dynamic and free. And so you have a message, I'm no good as an artist. And you think, that's just a thought. And then you go and paint.
So you're basically making a space between you and the thought.
You're making a space.
Emerged.
You're making a space, yeah. You're making a space. You're taking yourself, in a way, out of that. That's right.
The thought's just a thought.
Yeah. And it brings you with a little bit of intimacy to yourself, which is a really helpful thing, instead of being disconnected to yourself. So when you're mindful, even, you know, you say, I want to solve a problem of conflict, there's a lot of spin-off to that. Conflict may be, and we do a lot of work with cancer patients in Israel and in other Dharma communities in the world, and cancer patients that are ready to go through this process and be mindful of their own story, very often they look entirely differently at their situation. They get out of the victim mind, they get out of the complaining, life gave me shit, they get out of the complaining at the medical world and at others, they live with more joy and sympathy and intimacy with life. And the disease gives them a real power to do this, because it's a challenge, it's a deep challenge. Same with conflict, it's a deep challenge. So it's a driving force that can really help you to kind of go in there and see things differently. And the spin-off is you live more freely and with intimacy. You don't get controlled by these narratives. You live freely, step by step, moment by moment. So you get a lot of spin-off, a lot of joy. It's amazing to see the joy coming out of the cancer groups that we do. It's unbelievable. If they're ready to turn around and see the reality instead of the narrative, then release a huge joy, especially because they suffer, the suffering is there, so the joy is held, you know, and extraordinary transformations are happening. So, but I do want to say that, and it's something that Susie knows and teaches, and mindfulness teachers are, that in the Dharma, in the Buddhist teaching, mindfulness is never seen as a technical thing. There is a model of a spiritual journey which is very strong in the Buddhist teaching, which you can call a nutritional model. Nutritional means, what are we feeding? What is it that we feed in ourselves? And for example, attachment is a word, upadana, in the Second Noble Truth, is truth that we are attached. But attachment has a very negative quality to it, and in the meaning of that word in the Pali language, it also means feeding. That means feeding non-attachment. What is it that we feed, as well as what is it that we have to get rid of? So the nutritional model is very strong. It's all through the suttas. And the nutritional model will say, what are the values in mindfulness? Mindfulness is not technical. It's not just a technique. It has in it values. And especially when we're dealing with conflict, the values are important. And one of them we've mentioned already, which is kindness. Kindness is a value that is part of mindfulness. So therefore, if someone is teaching or you're studying mindfulness very technically, saying, I must be like, observe, you know, bear attention was a word. We don't hear that. But that was like in the 70s, when people were teaching mindfulness, they used to talk about it as bear attention. Joseph Goldstein wrote a book, you know, about this. It's gone, thankfully, more faithfully to the core teaching of the Buddha, which is that mindfulness has values. One of them is kindness, and mentioned compassion, and another one is intention. What is it that we are doing with this mindfulness? Where is it going? Where is it taking us? And here is something which you may not agree with, because it's a little subtle. But if we get into conflict with people, it actually becomes the known world for us. Now, if you think of sort of, maybe easier to think of this in the family context, we've got a family conflict that just goes on and on. We actually get invested in the conflict, and we actually want to maintain it, because that's the world we know. So we are deeply, somehow we are busy maintaining the conflict. One of the nutritional values that mindfulness would tell us is, do you really intend to finish the conflict, to stop the conflict? Are you willing to take risks? Are you willing to do something about it? Are you willing to make an effort? Like the peace walk, you know, are you willing to walk in the pouring rain? Are you ready to intend to finish conflict, to stop conflict? It's not such an easy, you think, everyone thinks, oh, yeah, you know, in Israel, like I said in the talk in front of in the peace, at the beginning of the peace walk, everyone's talking shalom, 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 but there's no real intention behind that word to actually finish conflict. It's just said, you know. So what's our intention? Intentions are important. So we can come to an intention to solve a problem of conflict. And it's very helpful for us to do that.
It's no question of priority. What's most important to you, to have a conflict with this person or to get the
Yeah. It's priority, you're right. It's priority. The intentions are about where you put your attention. And where you put your attention, which direction you put your attention. That's your intention. And in terms of dealing with conflict with mindfulness, one of the most powerful things we can do is apply mindfulness to the other person, as well as to yourself. Yourself, you're looking at narratives, but you can have an intention and you say, this is a good thing for me to do. It feeds, it's nutritional. I remember in peace, a lot of peace workshops we did with Israelis and Palestinians. We used to bring groups of Israelis to the Palestinian territories to sit with Palestinians for 48 hours on deep dialogue. And one beautiful Palestinian academic who was at the Madrid Peace Conference. He was at one of the international peace conferences, and he said, the only thing you need to do is put yourself in the other person's shoes. That's the only thing we have to do here. And if we can put ourselves in the other person's shoes, it's the end of the conflict. So, and there's a truth in that. So mindfulness there is applied mindfulness. That means going out with intention that is healthy, nutritional, feeding, to feel what it's like to be the other. That's why we did the groups, for example, in the Peace Walk. What is it like to be the other in their shoes? That's an intention. So you're in the middle of a fight with somebody. If you can, stop and say, what's it like to be you? Say to yourself. We'll do some exercises on this in the afternoon. We'll do some direct exercises. So that's another sort of aspect of the nutritional. And I think another aspect of the sort of nutritional side of things is to have a real sense of peace. Because we actually miss it. We don't really know what is peace. We want it, but we're not sure what it is, actually. So, on a deeper level, peace is in the nature of reality. It's the way everything relates to everything else. Like the tree is relating to the earth, and the earth is relating to the tree. And our digestive system is relating to our biochemistry, and our heart is relating to the lungs, and and we're relating to our family, and the sky is relating to the. It's all at peace, actually. Peace is totally there, everywhere, but it might be hard to see it because we have in us stories about non-peace, the restlessness and the inner conflicts and outer conflict. So we actually might not know what is peace. So part of the mindfulness is actually experiencing peace. And what's it like just to stop and to breathe and to be? And nothing wrong in this minute. It's just nothing wrong. I'm here on this earth breathing. I'm here on this earth standing. Nothing wrong. Totally peaceful. No problem. So kind of that's another aspect of the nutritional side of things, of mindfulness. So one small, I wanted to have a little, I know I'm going on a bit, but I do want to carry on with it, finish the talk. It's not going to be so long, like 10, 15 minutes. One aspect, like you can call it aspect of the nutritional side, but is quite important. And that is, okay, so we didn't do the job. We still have conflict around, and we still have narratives and so on. So does that mean that I go out and get into fights? Does that mean that it's okay to go to war? So we, you know, it's okay to go to war unless you are a mindfulness practitioner. It's sort of all or nothing. So there is a gap there. And the gap is filled by non-violence. And non-violence is a very important part of the spiritual life. And it's your commitment to, in a way, guarding your behavior. So it goes along with inner work, is also outer work. And if you think about it, it's kind of hard to do the inner work and have a nutritional attitude if outside you're making a big mess with other people. It just, as the Buddha said, it's like trying to row a boat that's tied to the bank with a rope. And the rope is the rope of ethics. So it kind of, ethics need to be dealt with. You need to have a sense of purity or ethical action. So non-violence is a kind of a important thing. I know that in everyone's mind, when you talk about non-violence, immediately comes up this thing, well, if he attacks me in the subway, you mean I should just give up and let him kill me and so on. These thoughts automatically arise. But I don't have time to go into the whole thing of non-violence. It needs another one-day workshop. But there's one key to understand it, which is that it's a way of life. It's not a principle that I mustn't protect myself or I mustn't be violent at any time. It's not a principle, it's a way of life. And a way of life that guides us. So hopefully it will influence our daily life and it will prevent violence, either to us or from us. Because it becomes part of our way of life. It becomes part of the way we are with the world. Which is why the monks don't kill insects. If they can. Because it's a way of life, a way of relationship to the world, which is pure. But it doesn't say that if someone's coming at you with a gun, and there's nothing else left to do, you don't protect yourself. It doesn't say that. The Buddha never said, never ever protect yourself. He said, live with valuing non-violence, so you do it more and more as you can. Christopher once told a story about his monastery where the abbot was talking, and there was a cup of tea next to him, and one of the young monks said, "There's a fly in the tea. Shall I take out the tea?" And the abbot said, "Yes, take it out." So the young monk came back 10 minutes later with a cup of tea without the fly in it and said to the abbot, "Here, he'll be all right now." I'm just telling that story because it's non-violence as a way of life, a way of relationship. And it does avoid violence as well. Because if you have a mind that is ready for violence, then it will tend to happen. It will pull it. And if you have a mind of non-violence, it will tend not to happen.
Well, I think it's got to be authentic.
It must be authentic,
because
you're right.
Otherwise it becomes kind of this new age thing where people
completely
pretend they're kind of non-violent, but inside there's this seething mass of hatred.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely 100%. And that's why I said it's not a principle. If it's a principle, you can be violent as you want and have a principle called non-violence. And it's a way of life. It's exactly, and you can translate, when I said way of life, you can translate it as authenticity. You're absolutely right.
So actually noticing the violence in yourself
is part of it.
It's part of it.
Yes. Yeah, completely. But I've been in situations that are potentially violent, and I know 100% that I'm, by not rebounding with violence, not responding with the violence in me, the person looks at my face and sees that I have nothing against him and there's no reason to have a fight right now and everything's fine, and you know, we can just not do it. We can just not fight, and suddenly everything goes. You know, the energy of violence just disappears, and it helps me to stop violence with other people. I remember there was just two people in a shop in a small town in Israel, they were just about to kill each other about nothing. Two guys, alpha males. They were just about to kill each other. It was like, and I just marched in the middle of them and spontaneously and said, "Gentlemen, do you think this is really necessary?" And they were sort of so shocked by this completely unexpected and not in the loop of violence that they just sort of stopped. I mean, it just because it's just worth remembering that life of non-violence contributes to everything that we're talking about and can protect you from violence too by sowing different seeds in the world, and you tend to reap different fruit, but no guarantees.
What about the love of drama?
The love of drama is
love of drama.
Yeah.
And that often,
yeah,
we have energy and anger that might have nothing to do with, but we want an excuse to act it out and to be dramatic and tense.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Where did we get that from? I guess we need to get it from somewhere else.
So I want to finish with a concept from Tibetan, from the Tibetan tradition, the concept of the Shambhala warrior, which you may know about this. It's a very beautiful concept. It's the fighter for peace who uses weapons of compassion and wisdom rather than weapons that cause harm. And the Shambhala warrior is coming two situations of conflict with courage, which is why he's a warrior, but with humility. And the courage, he's a warrior because he sees the narratives. When you have the courage to see your narratives, your painful narratives from the past, and see them for what they are, you're actually a warrior. You're actually, in some deep way, a fighter. You use nutrition. It's nutritional. It's not swords. You have the courage, ready to see the demons. And as soon as you see the demons, that they're really not demons at all, but they're just passing by, and then you've beaten them. So that's why in the Tibetan world it's called warrior. And Shambhala warrior. Shambhala is a kind of a mythic kingdom like Gan Eden, Garden of Eden. So it's the warrior from the Garden of Eden, if you like. And the thing about the Shambhala warrior is that it acknowledges that you can only really act spontaneously in your life. So as I said before, you know, you are who you are is how you are. So the Shambhala warrior is embodying peacemaking and ending of conflict in his being, and therefore when he spontaneously acts, he acts from that place. And when he acts from that place, and it's you're Shambhala warriors, and you sit down and meditate and you get up in the day and you in a way decide to live a little differently with more harmony, you're doing it. And if you can bring peace to somebody else, you're doing it. And very often the Shambhala warrior is invisible. You find them everywhere. They're in organizations that try and solve problems within the organization. They're in schools who try and solve problems with kids. They're in, you know, they're in the world. And you don't necessarily see them because they may be humble. And they may not be super Buddhists. But they're bringing a kind of authenticity, they're bringing a wisdom and a heartfulness, and they can be very often grandmothers and grandfathers. That maybe they're being ignored, but they do have an effect. And people don't even know that they're doing it. Very often the mind is changed, but you don't know how it happened. It's someone else is in a way sowing seeds around you, but you don't know how it happened. And the peace walks are of this kind. That's why they're quite different from usual political activity. They are making a model of what peace is like that then people can go off and use, and they don't know where they got that model. They don't. It's not that the peace walks and everyone's saying, now I must be like the peace walks. It's just that it's doing something on another level, saying, you know, this is what it's like. And the mind can shift and trust peace. And it's not clear, and no one's shouting, peace, 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 peace. But it's happening. So that's the invisibility of it. And the Shambhala worries can be invisible. And the final sentence about all of this is, when you're faced with the Shambhala warrior, which is you and me, when faced with the decisions having to be made, is it the right thing I'm doing? How do I make peace? How do I deal with so much conflict in the world? It all seems too difficult. All these kind of thoughts. The Shambhala warrior uses mindfulness in the present moment and trusting the spontaneity to solve these problems. The present moment always solves these problems in one way or another. You can have a sense, are we doing the best thing? Who can say? Is there a better thing that I can do for peace right now than this peace walk? Who can say? But right now, I'm walking on this earth in the present moment, and something is happening. And maybe someone will be shifted because of this. And that's what's happening.
How do you make a decision what to do?
Just a minute. So the kind of authenticity of being in the now and being aware, being mindful and being heartful in the present actually tells you solving these kind of problems that come up, and they do come up, of course, all the time. And the answer is always back in some place of sort of trusting who I am, trusting the moment. So let's just take one moment of silence, and I'll switch off this, and then we can have any questions.